At Breezeline, great connections come in pairs. Switch to fast fiber-powered internet for just $19.99 per month and get a free line for a year when you pair with Mobile. It's the perfect pair for the perfect price. Get the reliability you need and the value you want. Enjoy fast speeds for work or play. Connect at home or on the go and save every month. Don't miss this special offer on internet and mobile. Visit breezeline.com today.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world all around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We really appreciate it. Let people know about the program. The more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned. Coming up on this week's program, we'll be speaking to the man who endured over 200 snake bites for a reason. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or tweet us, we're at @newstalkscience. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined by Dr. Susan Kelleher of DCU and Dr. Laura Hayes of the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies. You're both very welcome. Susan, our first story has to do with flossing.
Yes, and not the dancing now, Jonathan, but the oral hygiene activity. Do you remember that song from, I think it was 97? Baz Luhrmann?
Yeah, it was a retirement speech put to music, right? And
exactly.
It was like learnings from a life or something like that. Yeah, I thought it was a bit trite.
Do you know what? Yeah. Trite or not, it stuck with me. And one of the key things that it stuck with was that word, floss. That was the kind of the bridge in the spoken poem. And it, you know, it stuck with me. And whether or not you, the listener, are an avid flosser or someone who needs convincing of its benefits, then this new story will be of interest. So this is a story about a new study from the Hiroshima University. And it found that the gum disease bacterium called Porphyromonas gingivalis can seep from your mouth into the bloodstream and then further on into your heart, where it can then cause fibrosis and it can mess with lots of electrical signals. Now, this might seem like a really strange connection, but clinicians have long ago noticed that people with gum disease seem to be more prone to cardiovascular problems. And a recent analysis shows that 30% people basically who have gum disease are at a 30% increased risk of atrial fibrillation.
Atrial fibrillation,
yeah,
really?
Exactly. So
that's huge.
Which is a really high percentage. And so there's a lot of interest in these bacteria in the body, how they get to where they're causing this trouble, this problem, and what you can do about it. And one theory is that originally they thought there were inflammatory markers from the bacteria inflammation in your gum line, that they were traveling to the sites of, you know, to the heart where they were causing these problems. However, researchers previous times have found DNA that comes from this bacteria that was thought to only obviously thrive in the mouth. So the fact that the bacterial DNA is being found in the heart valves, around the muscles, and in the plaques of the heart is telling us then it's not just biomarkers that are coming from that area, but rather the bacteria themselves are traveling to the site. And there's also potentially a systemic sort of a connection between those bacteria then and different systemic diseases, including Alzheimer's, diabetes, and even some sorts of cancers. So this work, yeah, it's really important because something so simple as flossing is what this, you know, ultimately implies, that keeping good care of your gum, which is flossing is a big thing part of, right? You know, that's going to help that. And the work that we're talking about today is published in a journal called Circulation. And it's found that this sneaky bacteria can get to, they've found it getting to the left atrium in mice. So basically they gave one cohort of mice an infection in their mouth, and then the second not. And that the ones who had the infection, they were at a 25% increased risk of this atrial fibrillation in the heart. So they had a much greater increase of things going wrong.
I hate flossing. Yeah. I really don't like the experience, and I floss, but I don't floss as regularly as I probably should. As soon as I read that story, I went and flossed. So we rarely get useful stuff out of this segment, I got to be honest with you, but that is useful. You need to floss more is the learning there. Laura, our second story is a really interesting one. It has to do with the apocalypse.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess the first thing is you probably still need to floss, even though there's an apocalypse. But this study really is quite interesting and kind of scary, right? So it looked at what would we eat if global trade suddenly collapsed. So what if a massive disaster happened, like a nuclear war or, you know, extreme climate change or a massive solar storm, and this cut off fuel and food imports into a city? So I mean, maybe it's you're a doomsdayer and you live in the countryside and you grow all your own food, you're grand. But what about modern cities? Could we actually survive by growing our own food if you live in a city? So this is a really interesting study where they actually looked at a city, a mid-sized city, which they said was an average city in New Zealand, population of around 90,000 people, so a little bit bigger than Galway. And they kind of calculated how much food, energy and protein people would need and what crops would grow best and would there be land available to do that. So I thought this was interesting. They thought, you know, the average person might need around 2,000 calories and in terms of protein, maybe 80 grams of protein. So they kind of did this like estimate analysis of what, you know, for the small areas of size, what can you grow best and can a city actually grow its own food? So short answer is you can.
Not cows.
Not cows, unfortunately. We'd all become vegetarians and it would not be avocado on toast. But basically what they did is they looked at Google Earth and they mapped out people's gardens and, you know, parks in a city and tried to see if you converted 75% of that area into actually growing crops, you could grow peas and potatoes. And this would be pretty good. You get a lot of your nutritional values from both of those things. They're very calorie dense in terms of the area that they can grow in. And they found with just, even just people's gardens and parks, they could feed 25% of the population. And then they said you need an extra, you know, space slightly outside the city to grow the rest. So they need an area slightly outside the city, maybe around 1.6 times the Phoenix Park. So, you know, not a huge amount of area, but a big enough area. And you could basically feed the population. Now, the key thing is if your disaster is a nuclear war and you have a nuclear winter, your potatoes and your peas aren't going to grow. So they don't really work well in cold conditions. It's going to be pretty cold if we are in a situation like that. So then they looked at, you know, what are frost hardy crops? So things like wheat and carrots and spinach. And they could actually looked at, we could actually survive on that food as well if that was the case. So I guess in one way of kind of, you know, we can do this in cities, which is good. But just kind of interesting perspective of maybe we need to have some preparedness for having our cities being able to be converted into these urban growing areas if we need to.
Seems like a strange thing to spend your time doing from a hypothetical point of view. Like, is the hypothesis that only the cities would survive and fields wouldn't? Because if the fields wouldn't, why would the parks?
For sure. I think it's more just like, you know, if you had a city with, you know, a very large population, it's very hard to go really far away to do your farming. So if you lived in the countryside and you had access to a farm, you'd be gone.
Yeah.
But how do you feed a huge amount of a population in a city without having kind of the functionality to be able to go and do kind of industrial scale farming, right? How can you be sustainable?
Okay. All right. Well, sometimes you come across these papers that people put an enormous amount of work into a hypothetical and you go, when would we ever need that? And then something like COVID comes along and you go, Oh, I see. mRNA vaccines actually are a good idea for us to see. Maybe they might work because actually, yeah, they did. They saved the whole world. Okay, our third.
You might be very glad of that. Yes,
could be absolutely when the AI apocalypse comes. Our third story, Susan, has to do with smelly plants, and as a chemist, you must love this story.
I love this story. So I did my PhD on sulfonamides. And while it's not relevant to this exact topic.
No, but it is. It's a humble brag right there.
It's a humble brag. What's sulfonamide? Everyone's Google sulfonamides now. Mic drop, sulfonamides. But sulfonamide have a sulfur and nitrogen bond. And they're not particularly interesting. Well, they were during the PhD, but they're not massively remarkable. But then when you swap that nitrogen for a hydrogen, now you've got what's called a thiol. And that stuff is super smelly. And people in our lab also worked with those. And I can tell you, firsthand, that they really do smell, regardless of fumigated use and all the correct procedures, they smell and they linger. So they, despite, like I said, all of the precaution, thiols are, you know, a really tricky thing to get rid of, and they really stink. And what people have now looked at is trying to figure out, from the super smelly plants, the smelliest, most foul smelling plants in the world, what's causing that smell? Researchers in the National Museum of Nature and Science in Tsubuka in Japan wanted to learn more about this genus called the Asarum plants, where they're very common in Japan. And like all great researchers, they pivoted rather slightly when they noticed that a lot of these plants actually smelled really, really bad. So what they did, they wanted to understand what causes this rancid, it smells like decaying meat kind of smell coming from these plants. So they analyzed 53 of these different species, and they analyzed all the volatile organic compounds, the VOCs, coming from them. And what they noticed is that plants that had the super smelly components had an enzyme in them that broke down the disulfide bond, which is the sulfur and a sulfur connected. And when that is split, it created that sulfur thiol, or the sulfur hydrogen of the thiol smell. And they found that there was only a difference in three amino acids between the enzyme that did this and the enzymes that didn't, which doesn't sound like, you know, maybe a big deal. But the fact is that there are co-evolution of plants with just these very small changes, which is really interesting from a plant evolution perspective as well. And what they're now starting to do is they think that there are different conditions under which these enzymes are produced that leads to the smell. And the idea is they're trying to understand why they smell.
Yeah, do these plants, do they stink bad because they want to attract animals, or do they stink bad because they want to repel animals?
Yeah, so there's a whole...
Or is it a byproduct?
They don't know. So there's a whole cohort of plants that do this on purpose in order to track the types of flies that are attracted, like blowflies and flies that are attracted to those like cadaver-esque smells. And when they're laying their eggs there, they accidentally pick up some pollen. But these guys are not those. They're not as smelly as that. They're pretty foul, but they don't attract that. Now, they're low-hanging, as in the flowers are very low to the ground, and they are kind of look a bit like rotting meat and that. So it's attracting, they think, little gnats and beetles to it. But they think that it might be a case of they're looking to see whether there's no smell, because some have it and some don't. They think they might be time related. So they're thinking that there might be a case where there's no smell bringing the, when they need pollinating, that they're brought in. And then when there's no pollinating, that the smell pushes them away to another plant, that then they will purposely not go that direction
when the
pollinating is finished. So that's what they're currently studying now as well. So it's just an interesting, I don't know, I love this stuff because the evolution of plants. When I studied my undergrad, we had an amazing lecture on plant biology. And this is the sort of stuff that's just fascinating to me. So while I'm a chemist, I'm intrigued by these sneaky plants, totally.
Sneaky plants. Very good. Our final story, Laura, has to do with self-aware fish.
Yeah, this is another kind of fascinating one and something that I really didn't think too much about right before, because you think memory like a goldfish, you don't really think fish have that much going on. but this is, these scientists study a really small stripy reef fish called a blue streak cleanser wrasse. And this is kind of a fish that's well known for being in like an underwater cleaning fish that actually cleans other fish. So I don't know if you remember that film Shark Tale years ago, where they were cleaning a whale basically in a car wash. This is basically that fish. And these are known to be clever, right? People have known that they've been clever for a while. But now they've seen they are self-aware, right? So they've passed this thing called a mirror test where they think these fish can actually recognize themselves in a mirror. And they've even gone a step further, which was shown these fish actually recognize themselves in photographs of themselves. So this is really kind of hinting at a deeper level of like self-recognition, and kind of puts them in the same company of, you know, dolphins and elephants and great apes and of course ourselves, which is kind of interesting. So they did this in an interesting way. They put these fish in a tank and, you know, they had access to a mirror for a while to kind of get used to a mirror. And then they put fake parasites on them right? And then they saw them in the mirror. And then what the fish tried to do is they recognized it in the mirror and then went to a rock to try scratch it off themselves. And this is how they passed the mirror test. They could actually recognize that, oh, that's me in the mirror. Oh, I have a parasite. I'm going to go fix that.
Which is such a great idea. I mean, we look at, you know, the hierarchy of intelligence, that this is one of those benchmarks that cognitive scientists have said, look, this is what separates stupid animals from smart animals. I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially, if you look in a mirror and you can tell that the person in the mirror or the thing in the mirror is you, then that is a level of higher order of intelligence. And they did the same with rooks and all the corvids. So corvids were one of the first, I think, birds that they figured out they were able to do this, but I think lots of birds can do it. But I haven't heard of fish being able to do it. And it's a really neat little test that they put it's a similar sort of idea that you put a spot in someone's back or whatever, and you can see, they can see it. Photographs, how do they do that? Because if I understand the moving, but you might move left and it moves left, and maybe you go, it's moving. You could add two and two together. If you're a little smart, little RAS, like I would be if I was a RAS. But how do they do it with a photograph, which is a static and very unnatural phenomenon?
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of interested about this too. I was like, how does that happen? So I think they were able to test this by, you know, they even said that these fish could recognize big fish and small fish in a photograph. And what they did was they showed the fish that passed the mirror test. So it was obviously some of these small fish aren't smart enough to pass the mirror test. But the ones that did, they showed them a photograph of themselves and a photograph of a different RAS fish. And basically what they showed is the fish attacked the photographs of the other RAS fish and didn't attack photographs of itself. So basically they're saying, well, they're recognizing in themselves that that's them. So, yeah.
That is really cool. Dr. Susan Keller and Dr. Laura Hayes, thank you so much. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, and would love to hear your reaction to this next interview, because what if the key to saving thousands lay in the veins of just one man? Well, Tim Freed has spent nearly 20 years injecting himself with the world's deadliest snake venoms, which, needless to say, is not advised. But he may have something close to a universal anti-venom in his veins. He joins us now. Tim, welcome to the program. This is quite an extraordinary thing to do with your time. Can you please give us some context and background to how you found yourself injecting yourself with snake venom, please?
Well, it pretty much started when I met Bill Haas in 1999 in Punta Gorda, Florida. At the time, I wasn't injecting venom. But after I met him, I thought it would be kind of curious to see if I could do it to myself. I didn't get any help from Bill. I had to do it all on my own.
Okay, so we need to back up a little bit. Who is Mr. Haas, and why on earth would a meeting with an individual make you do this? When was the first time you handled a snake, and why would you do that?
Yeah, well, Bill Haas is the pioneer of self-immunization with snake venom. His first injection was 1948. He's since passed at 100 years old. And it was really interesting because my logic was, at that point, if I made myself immune, I wouldn't have to use antivenom. First time I handled a snake, and the first time I was bitten, I was 5 years old by a garter snake. Didn't even know what it was at the time. And then I just got hooked on reptiles, and reptiles became my passion. And the older I got, the more I got into reptiles, although we don't have a lot of dangerous reptiles here. So, you know, through high school, we go to pet stores and just go herping for different things. It still didn't cross my mind at that point to self-immunize. I wasn't even aware that people died from snake bite. I just enjoyed snakes.
So you were 5 years old, you got bit by a snake, and Almost like an origin story for a superhero, you started being really interested in snakes of all kinds and started collecting them. Is that right?
Yeah, I would collect them and take them home to my parents' house and hide them in the basement in pickle jars. And my mom would get upset and call school and have me come home and take the snakes out. And so at that point, I realized that, well, maybe it's not the career for me. They're a phobia of people's, obviously. So my parents were afraid. So I had to get rid of the snakes. After I graduated high school, I wanted to go to the military. And then once I got out of that, I didn't know what to do. I didn't have a degree. I had really zero focus, zero direction, other than my love for reptiles. But with no degree and not going to school for herpetology, it's very hard to get a job in that field. It's virtually impossible. And it just kind of continued from there, and it slowly escalated. You know, when I first got married, is when I really started to get into it. But I didn't know what I was doing. Still really didn't realize how many people died from snake bite. And I slowly just kind of progressed into it.
So you are married. You are someone who was both bitten by a snake when you were younger, and you are someone who loves snakes but didn't get to study them. So you're surrounding yourself by snakes, but unaware that they are fatal for so many people. How does that happen? How do you play with snakes? That everyone has a natural and you know, phobia is tendency, you know, tends to be an irrational phobia. I think, you know, snake fear is probably a rational phobia for a lot of people. So were you in any way thinking about self-immunization, as you talk about? When did the idea of actually immunizing yourself against snake bites come? Did you have an incident where you were badly bitten?
No. Well, number one, it was a commitment to my friends. They knew what I wanted to do. They knew for years. They were afraid I was going to do it because they knew my tendencies, and as well as I did. And I just sat on it until one day I decided with my wife, ex-wife now, that this is what I'm going to do. And she was supportive of it, you know, at first. But then, you know, you realize what you're injecting in yourself and how lethal it really is. I mean, it's extremely lethal.
But why would you do something like that? That's what I don't understand. It's quite an extraordinary decision to make, Tim. Why would you say, I'm going to do this for them? Because it sounds like something very dangerous. And did you know what end? What was the point of this?
You can run away from snakes. You don't have to have snakes. But I like to solve puzzles. And since 125,000 people a year die from snake bite, 5 million are bitten and 400,000 have amputations or disfigurements. And I realized that if I can make myself immune, I'm not going to have that problem. I've only used antivenom once and I'd never used it again. So the first year was really, really rough. I made a lot of mistakes, a lot of errors. There's no book on it. There's no university that can teach you how to do it. So I had to teach myself how to do it.
So doing this, their goal was to self-immunize, is it? So that you would never need to worry about snakes? I mean, couldn't you just stay away from snakes? Would that not have been easier? Or were you thinking about the research that you ended up being a part of?
Well, the pain, a good analogy is if you're stung by a bee or a wasp or a fire ant, it burns just like snake venom does. The problem is the yield. Insects can have 1 to 2 milligrams. Venomous snakes can have 500, 600, 700 milligrams. So it's not just qualitative, it's quantitative. So that's what makes it so dangerous, and that's why so many people die from it.
Hmm.
And, you know, and I just decided, and I realized after I became immune and was studied for the second time in 2003 that I was very immune, I sat back and I was happy because I proved my point with bite. But at that point, I realized, how am I going to take this to the world? How am I going to take this 8,000 miles overseas to people I don't know, have never met, and probably never will meet?
But just as an aside to this conversation, which is so interesting, what does it feel like when you inject yourself with snake venom? Is it as bad as being bitten by that snake? And what sort of pain are we talking about?
As of 2018, I was at 200 bites and over 700 injections. And then at that point, I retired for many reasons. And yeah, you're right. They do make antivenom with other animals. But the problem with that is it's a foreign protein. So when that's injected in you, it causes IgE anaphylactic shock. And that can take you out faster than venom. People have died from shock faster than venom. So I'm beating two things. I'm beating the venom and I'm beating anaphylactic shock. And that for me was super interesting because I've had anaphylactic shock 12 times. Because I figured with one person, I only have so much blood. But then with the advent of biotechnology and cloning my antibodies into the millions, I don't need to use my blood anymore. I don't even need to have snakes anymore because they have everything they need. They basically took out my B cells and cloned my antibodies to make a library. And through that library, they were able to find, through a process called panning, my really good antibodies that target the four major snake venom family. But I didn't realize it at the time because I was like one person, but a human antivenom for me was way, way out of the ballpark. There's 64 families of snake venom. We are concerned with four of those families, which are three finger toxins, PLA2s, metalloproteinase, and serine proteinase. The other 60 are either synergistic or non-toxic to mammals. So we don't want that vial of antivenom to contain a lot of BNABs, broadly neutralizing antibodies that are useless. We want that vial to be very potent to the four big families.
Just as an aside here, I think it's important for people to know that the typical or traditional way that we harvest venom or anti-venom is we typically inject a horse with a very small amount of venom, and then that horse's immune system, because they're so strong, they don't typically die from this. They get an immune response that then is transferred to humans to then create anti-venom for them to essentially be treated with. So you inject these this anti-venom into the veins of a human, and they're able to resist the onset of the sort of attack that the venom creates. So we use horses for this. You have used yourself for this in a way which is almost beyond measure. So tell me about this, these studies that you've been taking part in, and what might be the benefits from them.
Yeah, and what the antibody engineers can do is they can tweak all this stuff right down to the amino acids and change amino acids to make it more critical for epitope binding, which is very important. And so that's really our main goal. But the problem with snake venom is venom variation. And there's no two snakes that are alike.
Oh, I see. So the snakes that that aren't particularly toxic and aren't particularly dangerous, you don't want the anti-venom for that. So there's a process of sort of refining the sort of anti-venom that is in your veins just for these four families of super dangerous snakes.
Well, in India, in the six different regions they occur, all those regions have different venom. See, if you make an antivenom in one region, is it going to work in the other region and vice versa? And that's the problem we have with the antivenom right now.
Right. Well, I mean, some of them are quite similar, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, pretty much. What I do is I do snakes individually so I know what they feel like. I've done all four mamas, but I broke all four mamas down in what a black mama feels like or a green mama feels like. And I break it down individually. You can mix them together too, but then you don't know what individually they feel like.
Right. Okay. So do you, when in the process of injecting yourself or getting bitten by all these snakes, do you have to go species by species through the various subspecies of a snake to ensure maximum immunity? Are you saying that the sensation of being bitten by a black mamba is different dramatically or in a way that you can sense from being bitten by a cobra?
100%. And I'll tell you why. Cobras have something in their venom that's called cytotoxins, which destroy your muscle cells. That's why there's so many amputations with cobras in Africa, all the way to India. Difference with the black mamba, or one antibody can neutralize pure black mamba venom. And the reason it can do that is because it recognizes the long nicotinic acetylcholine receptor toxins at the post side of the neuromuscular junction.
Right. So I don't know what that means, but it's clear for me from working with these snakes and injecting yourself with the venom, you've become quite an expert in the ways in which these venoms work their way through the body. Can I ask you, how you haven't died yet?
Well, I came close a bunch of times. Flatlined once, ICU. Like I said, 12 times anaphylactic shock. At least a dozen times passed out after double bites by Taipan and Black back-to-back, which I filmed. pulled through that. I have trained my body to become used to these toxins. And I've generated so many antibodies, IgG. I have twice as many in my system that are venom specific than you have in your body alone.
So let's talk about the actual practical application of this. Is it possible that your blood can be cultured, or the anti-venom in your blood can be cultured and developed into a universal anti-venom for almost every toxic snake? Is that something that we're trialing at the moment, or how promising is that research as far as you understand it?
Well, it's very promising because there's a lot of snakes that I've never used. Let's say King Cobra, I've never used it. But in vivo studies, I neutralized it. I don't have to inject anymore. And I don't eat snakes. I don't need snakes. I have a refrigerator full of venom here, dried venom that'll last me the next 50 years. I can just use dry venom.
Well, you know, I have to say, this has been such an interesting conversation because it is a life experience that I have zero overlap with. It's a really, really interesting thing that you've decided to do with your life. And it has been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Please look after yourself. And it would be great if you managed to make it to 100 years old yourself. It's been fascinating speaking with you. Tim, thank you so much for your time.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Jonathan.
It's funny when people just find a cause, how hardcore they will go in the pursuit of it. Let's look back at some of the comments from last week. We were speaking to Dr. Shelley Brady about the smell of epileptic seizures. It's a really cool Irish study. Rose says, Jonathan, I found that piece absolutely fascinating. It's amazing to have that technology so close that we might be able to predict when a seizure will happen. James says, does it take long to train these dogs? I was interested in your guest's observation that untrained dogs noted the smell. So would you need to obtain a trained dog to react to the upcoming seizure? Or could the dog you own use the collar to give an indication? You need to train the dog that when it smells that smell, that it spins around and the collar then picks it up, James. So the idea was, essentially, in case you didn't hear last week's episode, you're wondering what the hell is going on. They trained dogs who could smell the biomarkers or the chemicals that happen in someone's breath and their sweat ahead of a seizure. And when the dog smells that, they're trained to spin around, and the collar has a gyroscope and a sensor on it, and then it sends an email or a notification to the phone saying, you're about to have a seizure. Really clever. But I said my dog wouldn't be very good at that. And Louisa says, yes, Jonathan, my dog would hardly move in this type of scenario. He just cares about when he wants to be fed or walked. I'm starting to feel that way myself, Louisa. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
At Breezeline, get the perfect pair for the perfect price. Switch to fiber-powered gig internet for $49.99 per month and get a $250 gift card. Save even more when you add mobile and enjoy a free line for a year. Visit breezeline.com today.